So my topic is American military strategy after Iraq and Afghanistan. Iraq obviously is, as far as the Americans are concerned, in the past tense. Afghanistan isn't in the past tense yet. It still has a bit of a way to go. But I think you sort of sense people's minds are moving beyond it. There's going to be a messy conclusion there. That won't count as a complete defeat, but it won't count as a complete victory either. And thoughts are moving on to the next stage. Now, there's obviously one big difficulty of talking about the future of American military strategy, which is not knowing necessarily who the next president is going to be. And given the fact that there seems to be sort of a battle for Romney's foreign policy mind between John Bolton on the one hand, who some of you may know with no doubt happy memories for his grace and charm and moderation, and people like Stephen Hadley on the other, it's not altogether clear exactly how that will come out. I have to say Romney's statements at the moment, which is basically declaring most people to be an enemy of the United States, aren't desperately encouraging. But we'll see how that works out, because in a sense Romney's potential to become elected as president relies on the assumption that he doesn't really mean what he says or what he has had to say in order to get where he is so far. So I'm going to assume a degree of continuity in American policy, because actually a lot of what has been discussed so far since the Obama administration announced defense cuts and a so-called rebalancing has not been that controversial. Given all the things that are very controversial in American politics, in some ways defense is less controversial than one might expect. And I think that's partly because of the legacy of the last administration. The Republicans don't feel necessarily that this is as strong an issue upon which they can make advantage compared with, while Obama, of course, has got the I'm the one who got Osama bin Laden card to play. So in curious ways, whereas in the past, defense was the issue, one of the issues upon which you would expect to be big in an election year, I'm not sure it is in this year. And that tells you something possibly about the American mood and concerns about the nature of their international obligations and what they should do about it. Now, I want to start by using a comparator. And the comparator is post-Vietnam. After Vietnam was different. Vietnam, not at the point where the US left, but didn't take that long, was seen as a defeat. And I don't think Iraq or Afghanistan will quite be seen in that way. Can't be sure yet with Afghanistan, but I don't think so. The US Army, which had had a terrible time in Vietnam, and was going through amazing transitions, including the move from being a conscript army to a regular army. The relations had broken down between officers and men. The public opinion was not at all supportive. People coming back from Vietnam had a very bad time. The American military decided to rebuild themselves on the basis of their core mission. And the core mission was NATO. And they, someone put it, returned to the full the gap. They returned to preparing for a big war against the Warsaw Pact. And it was partly because that was still a strategic imperative. It was wholly warranted by American foreign policy. But at the same time, it was also their comfort zone. The United States Armed Forces are geared to big wars against proper enemies, in which they can use the full range, full spectrum warfare, if you like. And a lot of the ideas and concepts and systems with which we now see the Americans in action derive from that period. It was in the early 70s you first hear talk of smart weapons. The concepts of air land battle introduced a role for the relationship between land and air forces that should have, in a sense, been evident, but had not been so much a part of American practice before. A lot of the concepts, in a sense, first used in 1991 against Iraq in Desert Storm, can derive from really quite a major period of reorientation of the American armed forces that took place in the 1970s. Now, you haven't had quite the same experience in the 2000s, but you've had an experience which has left the United States population, military, allies, a bit tired, a bit uncertain about whether they really want to go that route again. But where is the comfort zone now? What do you do if you don't want to do counterinsurgency anymore? And that, to some extent, has been a question that has been hanging around there for a few years. Now, unlike Vietnam, the first answer was we're going to do counterinsurgency better. In the 1960s, the American Army, Marines, started off trying to go along with what they saw as a politician's enthusiasm for counterinsurgency. But they soon wished to recast Vietnam as an ordinary war. And to some extent, so did the North Vietnamese. And so eventually, by the time the North Vietnamese were sending divisions into the South, the Americans weren't on the ground anymore. But the idea of counterinsurgency in the 60s got discredited in the military mind. Now, that didn't happen in the last decade because under the leadership of Petraeus and a few people around Petraeus, they found out ways to sort of make it work, to make a certain sort of counterinsurgency operation work. But that required large-scale insertion of armed forces on the ground. And that is what you sense policymakers on both sides of the Atlantic really don't want to do, if possible, in the future. So though a degree of expertise has now developed in that form of warfare, there's not a lot of enthusiasm for deploying it on a regular basis in the future. And you can see that, obviously, with the Libya campaign, which was almost going back almost to where we thought we were going to be in the 1990s. Ended up in the 1990s. I mean, if you want to compare Libya, you don't compare it with Iraq or Afghanistan, you compare it with Kosovo, where we provide the air power, and what's going on the ground is up to indigenous forces of one sort or another. And issues about what you do for those indigenous forces, whether they're really the people you want to support. But it was pretty clear from the start of Libya that what wasn't going to happen was that American, North, for that matter, British or French forces were going to be deployed on the ground. So the starting point is a reluctance to fight counterinsurgency in that way. Furthermore, there's another way that's been, or counterterrorism in that way, there's another way that's been found, which is the use of drones. One of the major changes that's taken place in the conduct of warfare over the last few years, or certainly over the last decade, no more than that, is the use of unmanned aerial vehicles, often controlled from some distance away, that take out very specific targets on a quite regular basis. The follow-up to this spy story that has unaccountably reached the press, though it should have been kept secret, about the unfortunately named underpants bomber, was a drone attack in Yemen, where the boss of the operation was taken out. Now, this raises enormous issues, which I don't think people are beginning to address yet, of morality, legality, and politics. But as far as Obama is concerned, you can't say it's not effective. And it provides a way by which very specific problems can be addressed without having to rely on the sort of measures that were taken in 2001 to go after the Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. It is an interesting question, possible to answer, that if the levels of drone technology and confidence that we now have had been available in 2001, whether that would be the way that was done it. Remember that Clinton had tried to deal with the Al-Qaeda threat by cruise missile attacks in 1998, but these are much more effective than longer-range Tomahawks. So not only is there less interest in putting large-scale forces on the ground to deal with terrorists or insurgencies, but for the particular problem of direct threats to the United States, there seems to be, at the moment, another way of doing things. Now, one can imagine scenarios where that won't seem to be satisfactory, but that's the way I think the mindset is at the moment. So what then do you do? Well, along comes China, and China provides an answer to the need for a new focus, because while the United States has been preoccupied with Iraq and Afghanistan, China has been steadily building up its armed forces, engaged in quite substantial military modernization, and as serious, has been starting to throw its weight around in the Asia-Pacific region. And therefore, not only is there a sort of a supply-led push into Asia-Pacific for the United States, this is the sort of great power, balance of power stuff that they feel is an appropriate role, but there's a demand there as well. Local powers in the region want the United States to be there because they see a need to balance in some way the growing power of China and to give them some political space in which to assert their own interests. So the push is there. And this leads, I think, to one of the big questions, which it will be very much, I think, a matter for the NATO summit as well, which is what was first called the pivot and is now called the rebalancing of the United States in terms of a move from Europe to Asia Pacific. Not, they hasten to say, away from the Middle East. They're very clear that the commitments in the Middle East are unchanged, and of course there's big issues there that have to be addressed. But you're away from Europe and to the to Asia Pacific. Question one, should the Europeans be worried about this? It seems to me of all the things Europeans have to worry about at the moment, this is quite low down the list. There's a lot that Europe should be worried about, but actually these are the problems that we have to worry about are to a large extent of our own making, or else anyway, they're not about balance of power in the way that got the United States into Europe in the first place. Russia under Putin is a difficult and sometimes unpleasant power, but it isn't the power that it was. And the issues are very much around its periphery. There are issues with Russia, but there's not a lack of... We're not going back to the 175 divisions of the Warsaw Pact against which you had to have some sort of balance. So by and large, not to be a security concern is a good thing for a part of the world. It's better to be not considered to be dangerous and troublesome than to be dangerous and troublesome. And I think those who look at the Asia-Pacific region, which I don't think Europeans really do enough, will be aware that there are enormous tensions building up in that part of the world that are really quite dangerous because they're not, they don't involve small, weak states. In some cases, they involve quite large substantial states, and quite complex strategic relationships are developing, involving not just China, but India and Japan and Korea, with Australia watching on anxiously as well, and Russia too, plus, of course, the United States. So it's a very complex set of relationships. How much in all of this is the rise of China not only a question of Asia-Pacific, but a question of a shift in international politics? It's almost a cliche that the economic growth of China has put it in a position where it challenges for what is often described as, put it in quotes, global domination. Now, you don't have that good a memory to recall a very similar statement being made about the Japanese in the late 1980s. And the peak of those statements about Japanese power was followed by a period which really hasn't completely come to an end of stagnation in the Japanese economy. So being described as the next great power may well be the kiss of death for an economy. I think there are good reasons to be cautious about Japanese economic growth. I'm not an economist. People here can comment on that. But there are a lot of assumptions being made about the ability of China to carry on in the same growth pattern that it's shown. It's already slowing down. There are big environmental, demographic, enormous political issues at the moment that country is facing. So I would assume there will actually be a slowdown. But even if there isn't, there are enormous differences between the United States and China as major powers. China doesn't have two things that the US has. The first thing the United States has is, one way or the other, an appeal that goes well beyond its borders. For better or worse, and often with qualification, there is an American way of life, ideology, philosophy, shared in varying degrees with its allies in Europe, that is generally taken seriously. That's just not the case with China. People are not saying, gosh, China is becoming a major economic power, we better read Confucius. There is not the same ideological outreach, influence, that others have. People understand why China is in the position it is. By itself, of course, it doesn't, I mean, counting for a quarter of the world's population, it's got enough outreach within to keep it busy. But it doesn't have that as one of the things going for it. It is viewed and views itself in its international relations in very traditional realpolitik, often quite even mercantilist terms. Secondly, it doesn't have allies. I mean, the closest it gets is North Korea, which is not a great start. Whereas the United States has security relationships of one sort or another with about 70 different states. I mean, not always close allies, but many are close allies. With its allies, the United States probably accounts for about 75% of world military expenditure. By itself, it's accounted for about half. That's now going down. But it's still in a completely different position than China. China doesn't have those advantages. And the third point one might make after those is, why would China want to be a great power anyway? It's sort of an assumption of this sort of global domination notion that power is something that will allow you to boss everybody around and tell them what to do. But actually, in terms of what great powerness means in this day and age, it often involves as many responsibilities as entitlements. To be a great power means having to address issues like Libya or Syria at the moment, where China often seems to prefer to take a back seat and indicate if it doesn't directly affect our national interests, it's nothing to do with us. China is undoubtedly an important regional power, and sees a role for itself there. It has global interest, particularly on the resource side, and that can provide a lot of interesting challenges for China and also the countries where it's put, where it has an interest in reserves. But that doesn't make it thinking about itself in terms of the sort of great poweredness that we have seen in the past. So I think the question of China is an Asia-Pacific issue more than a global issue. It's a serious Asia-Pacific issue, and I think here come the questions for the United States. And I'll just mention two, because I'm conscious of time. The first is, in effect, what the Americans are doing, meeting the demand from the region, is saying, yeah, we're here to balance the power of China. We, at the same time, we want to have cooperative relations with China. And so there's already a tension there. It's a very different relationship to the Cold War relationship with the Soviet Union. Interesting to think how the Cold War would have played out if the United States had owed the Soviet Union the amount of money that it owes China, or if China had been sending quite as many goods, or if Russia had been sending quite as many goods to the United States as China sends to the US. It's a very different sort of relationship, which doesn't lend itself naturally to out-and-out hostility. The degrees of mutual interest in that relationship are quite serious. But the local powers, local countries, see an opportunity in this, which may be to the good in some instances, and may be helpful. Arguably, what's been going on in Burma is to some extent the result of the United States taking a greater interest, and the Burmese, who felt too dependent upon the Chinese, seeing an opportunity to give themselves a bit of space and even open up to the rest of the world and reform a bit. But there are big issues in the South China Sea, which we really shouldn't underestimate, where there are hard conflicts of interest between the Vietnamese and the Chinese, for example, Philippines and others, that could lead to trouble. And it's an interesting question, no more, as to how much that had been thought through. The other issue is, although people have talked about rebalancing, this isn't actually about an enormous shift of resources into the Asia-Pacific. The US is cutting its budget. There's a move out of Europe, but there's not a great move into the Asia-Pacific. This isn't a major American build-up. And that, too, raises questions. And one of the things you can see the Americans doing at the moment is actually starting to think through, well, if we are putting ourselves in a more potentially confrontational position with the Chinese, how well placed are we to do it? Because a lot of American bases in the region are actually quite close to China, or in missile distance, if you like. And so one of the things you can see the Americans doing is looking for basing a bit further away, in Guam and in Darwin, Australia, two of the developments that are taking place. So that is another question that they also have to address. Let me conclude to round this off on questions you raised, Mr. Chairman, a NATO question and an intervention question. I think the NATO question, as I've indicated, I don't think is a particularly difficult one. My view of NATO is it's really useful just by existing, because the most dangerous things, dangerous moments in international affairs are those moments in times of crisis when coalitions are forming and falling apart, coming together. To have your alliance in place saves you a lot of worry at a time of crisis. You know, Russia knows what the situation is in Europe, and I don't myself see that's going to change. So what you want from the NATO summit is an affirmation that it's a good thing that NATO exists. The difficulty for NATO is people want more. They want it to be active and bouncing around the world and doing important things. And there's not a lot after Afghanistan. I don't think that's going to happen much more. And actually, quite a lot of members of NATO would rather it focused actually on the border with Russia. So I think it's important that NATO stays boring, but exists. That's all it needs to do. A much more difficult issue is the intervention issue. During the 1990s, we came to accept that one of the things the major Western powers had to do on occasion was intervene for quote-unquote humanitarian reasons in relevant parts of the world. I mean, it wasn't everywhere and anywhere. A lot of the intervention, as Douglas Hurd will recall, was very close to home in the former Yugoslavia. Some of it was in Africa. But it reflected an assumption that there was a sort of responsibility. It came known as the responsibility to protect. I have to say, as somebody who was generally in favour of this development, it seems to me enormous limits on how far that's going to be taken at the moment. I've already mentioned Libya. You know, Libya is a small case, really. Few million population. A regime on the run. And it almost exhausted us. It came out okay in the end. I think it will come out okay in the end. But this was small beer. It's not, I mean, people say, well, we did Libya, why not Syria? Well, Syria is a bigger country and much more complicated. And you can see the reluctance to get involved directly. It may happen, but you can see the reluctance there. Budgets are tight. Preoccupations are much more local. And I think it may be that the 1990s turns out to be an anomaly. And Iraq and Afghanistan turn out to be anomalous. Though at the time, you know, thinking about the lessons for the future, maybe the lesson is that the period when the Western powers felt strong enough to take on these issues may have passed. It may not be a complete either-or, but we may be moving into a period when, if countries get into trouble, we watch and may get upset, but we don't do very much, apart from things at the margins or resolutions at the UN about it. And that's just a final point to note on. The only reason why I think the Americans may find it hard to stay away, to move away from Europe, than we might think at the moment, is because of the Eurozone crisis. It's a topic for another day in another lecture, but I really don't think people have cottoned on to just how quite serious this could be. In security terms, we're all focusing on the economic side, but the developments in Greece last weekend and into the weekend before and into this weekend are really quite unnerving and not surprising. Not at all surprising given the pressures that are being put on these societies. And there comes a point, if Europe starts to fragment, when actually we'll look again, as we have done in the past, to the United States. It's one of the few countries that can sort of broker deals. If we get a Greek-Turkish problem developing, for example, it's not altogether clear how Western Europe is going to be in a particularly good position to handle it. So I just think it's just a marker that we may be on at the start of a set of very different types of security issues in Europe that may require a very different sort of engagement. And on that not too cheerful note, I think I'll stop.
Well done.